We're talking wine, and not in a pretentious sort of way, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The truth is, our palate is our own, right? There's no secret code for choosing the right, air quotes there, wine, but it's nice to get pointed in a direction. And for me, it's the vocabulary where I raise that eyebrow. I get bogged down in tannic and oaky and legs and moody, like, what does that mean? What is your question about wine? Just say it, 800-642-1234. Elizabeth Schneider is a certified sommelier through the Court of Master Sommeliers. She is a wine expert, plain and simple, host of the podcast Wine for Normal People and author of the book by the same name. Elizabeth, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So when I'm staring aimlessly at the wine shelves in the grocery store, I pick a wine largely because of clever names and labels. Like, you know, I've grown to love storyteller wines because the word speaks to me. I'm doing this all wrong, right?
Well, it's not that. I mean, it's this whole sense of manipulation that they're trying to make you do that. So you're just doing what the wine companies want you to do. And you are obviously not alone. They're very, very skilled at this. But I think the most important thing about wine to understand is that it's like every other hobby. You've got to study a little bit in order to get into it, right? If you hit a golf course, which I would never do because one time I tried it and they kicked me off, you would have to know all of those, like, and I'm just going to make these up because I clearly have no idea, like birdie or whatever. All I know is like hole in one, whatever it is. You just have to know all of that. The putter, like what's the difference between all of those things? So anybody who takes up a hobby, you've got to know what that is. The problem is somehow wine has become this thing where you go into the wine shop and it feels like they don't want you to know what that is. Like you were saying, tannic and oaky. I mean, if people don't want you to know what that is, then, you know, how are you ever, it's like walking into the middle of a movie.
Yeah. So we have to get a little bit of feel for the terminology, but still got to break down some barriers here because, you know, wine has that kind of snobbish thing going on when people who say they know about wine. I want to get to a bit of a confessional here. More than once, I forgot to chill a white wine before dinner. So I throw it in the freezer. I set a timer for like, I don't know, 5 minutes and then finish it off in the fridge. Is that like good, bad, or ugly?
Well, it's actually fine, but there's a quicker way to do it if you want to know the truth. So, and a couple things about serving temperature. This is an incredible thing, but you can practice it yourself. We generally drink our whites too cold and we drink our reds too warm. So red should be around 55 degrees. I actually like mine a little bit colder than that. So that means definitely not sitting on your counter temperature. So they should be in the fridge for like an hour before you drink them or 45 minutes. But if you want to chill down a white really quickly, you actually make an ice bath. So you could just take a regular bowl. That's what I do. I don't have anything fancy. And you just put some ice in it and some cold water. And then submerge the bottle, and it will chill it down a lot quicker.
Oh, okay. Why does a red sometimes give me a headache? Why do I get that?
Well, there's only really one useful piece of information about what's in the bottle right now until we can see if we can get ingredient labeling on wine pushed through, and that is the alcohol level. Mm. So you need to start looking at the alcohol levels on wine. So a lot of them are 13% alcohol, 14% alcohol. And if you're drinking a lot of domestic wine, there is a rule where it can be 1 to 1.5% higher or lower. It's generally higher on the alcohol. So you're drinking wines that are 15% alcohol and likely you're not having water, sometimes no food. Mm. That is going to give you a headache for sure.
Yeah, yeah. How should I store my wine?
Well, I prefer wine fridges just because, like I said, serving temperature to me really, it makes such a difference in the flavor of the wine. So there are a couple factors. Wine is really sensitive to light. So the number one thing is you definitely don't want it in direct contact with natural light. It should have a little bit of humidity because corks need to stay moist. If it's a cork, you know, wine that has a cork closure, they have to stay moist or else they'll crumble. And then, you know, that temperature, keeping a steady temperature will make sure that the wine doesn't get messed up.
Is it important to have it on its side or, you know, what happens if after you've opened it? How, you know, what can you do with your wine?
So if it, that reason that we store it on the side is so, again, that cork stays in contact with a little bit of the wine so it doesn't get crumbly. So that's the main reason we do that. And then after, you're saying after you open it, where do you put it?
Yeah.
I usually put it in the fridge, even if it's red.
Okay. What about twist tops these days, and how would you store that?
Well, those are fantastic. I don't know if you, I don't know how you feel about them, but you know, here's a really cool thing about them. First of all, convenience, so awesome, right?
Yeah.
And I will make the confession that some nights I will look in my wine fridge and be like, "What has a screw top?" Because I just don't want to deal with the cork. But you know, technology's actually come a really long way. You can't see it, but there are different types of screw tops. Some of them actually let air in and let the wine change and evolve. So they're not all the same. But those you don't have to store on their side because, again, the whole point of that is for cork. Although, like, if you have a wine refrigerator, you're going to be storing it on the side because that's how everything is. But you could just store that upright. Again, another thing, I always say store it cool and then warm it up. You know, leave it out for a while to get it to the temperature that you want. You can even pour it in the wine glass. That'll warm it up a little bit, or a decanter if you're into that. But a wine glass is a decanter, let's face it. So, you know, you could just use that. You don't need a fancy decanter.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Elizabeth Schneider. She is a certified sommelier through the Court of Master Sommeliers. She's a certified specialist of wine. You can join in. What do you love about wine? What wines have you tried recently? What suggestions are you looking for? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. So, Elizabeth, I've heard a lot about some clean wines lately. What is clean wine?
Yeah, your guess is as good as mine. There's no such thing as that. It's just, again, this is one of these things that people are trying to market and gimmick. This is the one thing that I really want to get across about wine. The thing that I love and the people that make wine love, you know, most of them are small producers. They are farmers. The difference between wine and beer and spirits is that wine is an agricultural product in a very true sense of the word. Every year in the wine industry, we rely on a crop. And if the crop doesn't go well, the wine is not going to taste good. So, you know, clean wine, to me, that says, I don't even understand what that is. There's a huge debate going on about why anybody would ever say that. And then there's this whole other thing about natural wine, which again is this, many of us in the industry also think is a little bit ridiculous because we have spent a long time trying to get things like microbes out of wine that make the wine taste funky and icky. And now people are saying, well, that's not right. But they've been doing this since, like, you know, Roman times. So I'm not sure what the idea is there. But again, if it helps them with creativity, that's great. Clean wine to me, total gimmick.
All right. Well, you know, it's starting to look like spring in Wisconsin, which means, you know, we might want to go a little bit lighter with our wines, just, you know, kind of change them up a little bit. What would you suggest?
Well, it's rosé season, first of all. So the rosés for 2020 are about to be released. That's always a really good thing to have, especially when they're fresh right out of the tank, basically, and they come to us. So that's great. Rosé is usually a fresh, really acidic, aromatic wine. It is not sweet. If it says rosé, if it says white Zinfandel, it generally will be sweet. But it is, you know, what a great summer wine because it's a transition wine. I think of spring as this really lovely transition season. So you want these wines that maybe have a little bit more weight than what we're going to get when it gets blazing in the summertime, but still are refreshing. So, you know, some wines that I think people don't look at are the white wines of Spain, which are pretty delicious. There's a wine called Verdejo. I mean, for, $10-$12 a bottle, you get this really lovely wine. It's similar to a Sauvignon Blanc, but it's got a little more cheek coating quality to it. Albarino also is one that I think a lot of people know, or you could find it very easily too. And that's something that's got, you know, peachy aromatics. It's kind of like a lemon cookie, good acidity. It really is very, very lovely. Portugal also has great blends too, and they're ridiculously inexpensive. So if you're not worried about what's on the label and you don't obsess over, I have to have this grape, you can get a lot of really cool stuff.
Wine professional Elizabeth Schneider is fielding all your questions about choosing wine, maybe for a special meal or just because on a spring evening. Are you looking to venture out into new wines? What questions do you have about what to try? What are some of the flavors you really enjoy? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Elizabeth Schneider here on the Ideas Network. It's spring. We're thinking about wine here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Maybe it is time to embrace some lighter, fresher flavors, perhaps a rosé, as Elizabeth suggested. But this hour isn't highbrow. We're getting practical tips about wine and how to select a bottle. So wine geeks, be patient with us. Have you been to a tasting room recently in Wisconsin? Where did you go? What wines did you try? Do you prefer whites or reds, dry, sweet? What suggestions do you seek? 800-642-1234. Our guide is certified sommelier Elizabeth Schneider, and she hosts the podcast Wine for Normal People. She's with us for the hour. So, Elizabeth, you know, here in Wisconsin, we happen to like cheese. We take our cheese very seriously. So what do we need to know about pairing wine and cheese?
Well, you guys are so lucky that you have that opportunity to have fresh cheese from real people who make the cheese, right? This is goes back to my whole philosophy about, you know, I try not to buy big wine brands because, as you know, you just said, you know, there's a lot of local people making wine, and I mean that all over the world, right? Small producers, people you've never heard of before. So instead of buying, you know, the Gallo Brothers or these big grocery store brands, supporting these small wineries is so important, just like supporting the small cheese companies is. But you've got the world at your feet there. So there's a certain types of cheeses that are going to go really well. So you've got your soft cheeses, you know, goat cheeses and the fresh cheeses that are ricottas, things like that. Those are going to go really well with, you know, higher acidity white wines. There's, you know, Sauvignon Blanc, the traditional pairing, the very, you know, fancy pairing is, you know, Chèvre, which is the goat cheese from France, with Sancerre, which is a Sauvignon Blanc wine. So Sauvignon Blanc is a great pairing, and anything with high acidity. There's a bunch of wines actually in cooler climate whites, so things where you know, it's not really hot. When you think about northern France, Germany, I mean, Riesling is just so underrated, so underpriced for what it is. And there's a lot of dry versions for those who don't like sweet. Those are great. Then you've got, you know, your kind of middle cheeses, the things that are kind of not so, you know, not hard, not soft, the middle cheeses, the cheddars and things like that. And those are so versatile. Merlot goes well with those. You can do a nice Chardonnay, either oaky or not. And then, you know, there's the stinky cheeses, which are a little harder to pair with.
We like them all the same.
Yeah, like Munster and things like that. A little bit harder to pair. You need something real strong with that, you know, a really big Zinfandel or even a sweet wine could go well with that. And then, you know, your hard cheeses are really where all the reds play. Okay. I mean, like an aged Gouda, I think there is very little more delicious than an aged Gouda with either Bordeaux, which, by the way, is not a snotty one because it's like 1.5% of all the world's vineyards. So you got to figure most of that stuff's not high end. It's not, you know, or a nice Cabernet Sauvignon, or Chile. It makes fantastic Cabernet Sauvignon for a great price. So those hard cheeses, you know, like, I don't know if you've ever had a really great, you know, aged Gouda with the crystals, the caramelized crystals. Oh my gosh, that doesn't, there's nothing better than like a, you know, a wine with, and you mentioned tannin before, that mouth drying feeling, right? Different from acidity, which is underneath your tongue watering, that lemon. I mean, even right now there's this psychological thing where if I right now, I'm going to say this to you, I'm in my kitchen, I get a lemon out, I cut the lemon, right, and I see it, and it's juicy, and your mouth is watering right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So that's acidity. We can do that without even having anything in front of us. It's just human reaction. So that's the same thing in wine. Wine has, you know, it has varying levels of acidity. Most of it's very acidic. So, but that's what makes it go so well with food.
You know, you mentioned oaky. How does a wine become oaky?
What a great question. So not all wines go in an oak barrel, but what happened, this is, again, it's all sort of this fantastic, fascinating history of being wrapped up in things from so long ago. That's part of the thing I love about wine. they needed a place to store the wine, right? They needed a place to put it where it wouldn't spoil. They could have it sit. So at first, you know, in ancient Mesopotamia, they were using palm because that's what they had. But they found that it was very difficult to bend it and make it into a shape that they could use to store things in. So then it went into amphora, the clay amphora, which people are using once again. And those actually are pretty good for wine in terms of both longevity and flavor. But then they realized that oak trees, especially as things moved over to the west, moved to, you know, Italy and France, there were a lot of oak forests. So they decided to make those vessels out of oak. And they bent, in order to bend oak, they found that it was easier to burn it a little bit, and then you can flex it and move it. So then they also found that that can put some things in the wine. Like, think about it this way. You ever get, like, a brand new plastic water bottle?
Yeah.
You fill it up, and the water tastes plasticky, and you're like, ugh, I'm going to put this through the dishwasher about 10 more times. So a lot of liquid takes on the flavor of the vessel for good or for bad. That's how oak winds up giving flavor to wine sometimes. The issue is that sometimes it's too much, and it's up to the winemaker to decide what they want to do about that. I will say in Europe, they don't look at it as a flavor component.
Okay.
They look at it more as something that can stabilize those tannins. There's actually tannin in oak, and it's a plant compound, and in wine. And the oak will stabilize the tannin in the wine and actually make it more shelf stable. So for a longer period of time, make it age better. It also helps with the color, keeping those pigments constant. So they don't generally use it as a flavoring. In the United States, in Australia, somewhat in Argentina and Chile, the New World, as we call it, right? Anywhere that's not Europe, they use it more as a flavor component. So if you don't prefer those oaky flavors, Europe may be a better choice for you in terms of shopping for wine.
Good to know. We have Elizabeth Schneider, if you're just joining us, talking wine with us this morning. She is our guide. She hosts the podcast Wine for Normal People. You can join in. Do you prefer whites or reds? Maybe you appreciate oaky. What do you want to understand about wine? What tips or suggestions are you seeking? 800-642-1234. Saul is joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Yes, I'm one of those non-Okies. And is it true that most of the California vineyards really are heavy on oak? Because I've heard about people and their taste of cilantro that some people just can't stand it. That's the way I feel about most of the California wines, and they oak their reds. I know whites are oaked a lot, but even some of the reds are oaked.
Yep.
So I'm wondering, is there any genetic component to that, or is it just preference?
For you, you mean, your absolute hatred of oak, is it genetic?
Well, I mean, you can't talk in my specific case, but I'm wondering whether, I know with cilantro, it's a genetic thing that some people, it tastes like soap.
No,
and in my case,
it's not genetic. This is total preference. But so can you describe, like, you know, what is there a wine that you do like that's not from California, like a red? That would be helpful.
Oh, no, there are California wines that I like, but most of the whites that I've had have been really heavily oaked.
Yeah,
and
the Chardonnay.
I wonder if that's, I think you already answered the question that some vineyards just add a lot of extra for flavor. And
you know what it is, Saul? First of all, I completely understand what you're saying. The first time that I started drinking California whites, that really heavy oak component to me reads as chemical. So I really also do not like heavily oaked wines. However, that has to do with, interestingly, it's not genetic. This has to do with your preference, 100%. And remember when I was talking about burning the inside of the barrels? You don't have to burn them that much to get the barrels to bend. But if you ever go out to California, what you'll see is on almost all the barrels, there's a little M with a plus. That means medium plus toast, or there might be an H. They heavily toast the barrels because they are looking for that flavor component. And I think that for you, it may be better to look for things that are not oaked. Now, this is not standard across California. It really is producer by producer. And some of these places, and I hate to single it out, but Napa Valley is just known for really heavy oak. So these wines are, you know, that's what people have come to expect. And as a result, they just taste, you know, all it reads is as oak. It doesn't, and you know, these days especially, I think fall is completely on trend. We're looking for things that taste more like the fruit. And I think a lot of people, especially, like I said, the smaller producers are saying, look, I spent all this season growing these grapes. Do I really want to cover up the flavor with oak? That's what it does, right? It can really mask some of that flavor. So I'm with you. I think, you know, you might want to look into some of the wines from like Loire Valley, Germany, the northern part of Italy, where they don't really use that much oak. Really fantastic stuff, not very expensive, and you won't get those notes at all.
Elizabeth Schneider is a certified sommelier, and she's sharing her deep knowledge of the wine industry and how to best taste a glass of wine. Join in. What's on your mind about wine? Did you try a virtual wine tasting in the pandemic? What was it like? What did you discover about wine that you can share with us? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking wine here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So boxed wine sales surged amid the pandemic, and Wine Business Monthly reports that the stigma of boxed wine being of poor quality is quickly diminishing as new brands hit stores and sales, they show no signs of slowing. Do you drink boxed wine? Hello, Franzia. Anyone, what do you like about it? Is it the taste, the convenience? Join in 800-642-1234. Elizabeth Schneider is a certified specialist of wine through the Society of Wine Educators. She hosts the podcast Wine for Normal People, and she's with us for the hour. Elizabeth, we heard from Ben in Wausau, couldn't stay with us, but Ben is very interested in your reaction to boxed wines. Where do you stand on it?
Well, you know, boxed wine is actually a fantastic way for us to enjoy everyday wine and to continue to have it and have it stay fresh. We just in this country have not been able to get behind it for a really long time. And in other countries, it's quite popular, actually. I remember going to South Africa a long time ago and being like, wow, these people are drinking boxed wine. And it was good. It was good stuff. Part of the problem for boxed wine is, you mentioned Franzia. I mean, with stuff of that quality, who wants to drink it? But if you get better quality, I mean, that stuff, you want to talk about, like, that's barely farming, right? They're really, that's like really bad farming, really bad grapes. I mean, ugh, we could go into that. But the point is, as the boxed wine, as we become more open to boxed wine, just like screw cap, like we were talking about before, they'll put better stuff in the box and then we'll be able to drink it better. My only hang up with boxed wine is that I always encourage people to drink a lot of different things. Don't get hung up on one particular wine. I always say, you know, sort of tongue in cheek, don't drink what you like. If you do that, the world of wine is huge. Then you won't get to try this weird stuff from Sicily or Greece or Southern Italy or Chile. That's so fantastic. And I think the whole key for wine right now is, especially, gosh, we live in the United States. We are so lucky. We're like the biggest, you know, wine market, and everything is available to us. So to get stuck on one thing is a little tough. I would always encourage people to keep buying very different things all the time. You never know what you're going to find.
Well, when you mentioned bad farming, bad grapes, you know, what, as you look at the, you know, that whole part of raising the grapes and the whole process of making wine, what do you see there in terms of doing that sustainably, doing that so that you're going to also get a great bottle of wine?
It is so interesting because this follows, people don't think of wine as farming, but I always try to reorient people. You know, I mean, this is, in my book, I spend a whole chapter talking about vineyard words and about, you know, winemaking terms, because so much of the vocabulary, the important part of the vocabulary, because the book is really vocabulary and geography, right? So much of the vocabulary is based around farming. And if we can reorient ourselves and get away from the snottiness from wine comes from who's drinking it, not from who's making it, right? So if we can sort of think about farming, we know, I mean, look, you know, you're in Wisconsin. There are a lot of farmers there.
Yeah.
And you've got to think about the difference between industrial farming And those people, those men and women who are at the farmer's market, and we have the same exact thing in wine. Now, you might have to pay a little bit more. It's not ridiculously more, but that big farming, we're talking about, and I tell you, I worked after, I went to business school, and afterwards, I worked for a large winery. So I have seen this. They have these giant tracts of land. Barely anyone is manning them. They're growing in hot sun. Best wines grow in places where they have warm days and cool nights. It's basically hot the whole time. They literally add like buckets of acidity to re-acidify wine. If you make wine in a good place, the grapes should continue to have acidity. You shouldn't have to add that, right? Or just a very small amount. But the number of additives, the stuff you're putting into your body, the fact that they're going into these enormous industrial tanks and they're putting color in and they're putting all this kind of stuff. If you go to a small winemaker, even if you just go locally to Wisconsin, you'll see not only do they not do that, they don't even have the resources to do that, right? They're not buying things to dump into those tanks. It's the same exact thing. Again, wine is farming. It's a really, really interesting like paradigm shift, but I think it makes people feel more comfortable once you realize the people behind it who are, they're either industrial farmers, and yes, they don't care about the environment quite as much. They are definitely in it, you know, just to make the money. That's the stuff on the grocery store shelves a lot of the time. And the smaller ones are the ones who are really, look, they've owned the land. They live on the property. Who wants to pollute that, you know?
You know, along these lines, Michael sent us an email and mentioned loving the farm-to-table movement and has recently led Michael to really great local grapes at wineries like Parallel 44 and the grape varieties like Marquette and St. Pepin. What should we look inward at our own state when we start to, consider wines and what we should try?
Absolutely. I mean, support local. But I think we also have to realize that in wine, it's okay to support people not local because you can't always get what you want locally, right? So yes, you should absolutely always support your local wine industry if you can. However, I am never an advocate of being like, you have to have that even if you don't like the grapes. If you don't like the grapes, there's plenty of other ways to support other small producers, right? So that's the whole point is to try to. So on my website, I don't mean to be too like, you know, promotional. I actually, because I am sort of anti-big wine, I have a list. There's a section called resources of all the wineries that are owned by the wineries, right? Those labels that are owned by big wine brands. And I have a list. You could sort it and see which one it is and see who owns what. So there's a lot of different ways to go about it. But these, you know, all of that stuff on the grocery store shelf is owned by the Gallo Brothers or it's owned by the wine group or Kendall Jackson. So yeah, support local. And then if you don't care for your local wine industry, nobody's going to, you know, I mean, there are different grapes, different things grow in different places. Again, nobody's going to tell you not to buy, you know, cheese from France if you like that specific type that's not made in the same way, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we just have to get a little bit more creative, but totally support local, but then also support small.
We talked earlier about education, about not choosing wines blindly, but, you know, having a little bit of way of becoming educated. And in the pandemic, there have been a lot of virtual wine tastings. Have you gone to any or what do you think about how we approach wine in these times?
Well, I have actually had an online wine school for 6 years. So I have been teaching online wine classes way before the pandemic, partially because the place that I was in, I was living in Atlanta, Georgia at the time, and people really weren't interested in paying for wine classes. And because I have a national or international platform through my podcast, people started saying, hey, listen, could you please teach us wine? Teach us these wine classes. So I started doing it. And I will tell you, actually, this is a trend that has been, for me, it was really slow to start. And I did it basically because I love my listeners and I love wine. So, but in 2019, there was a big shift. And I mean, I was already on Zoom in 2019. People really started to sign up for these classes. And of course, last year it was insane and it continues to be really great. I think the greatest thing for me about the online wine school is that I, at least for me as a wine teacher, as somebody who has a, I teach classes every Saturday, basically, is that you have an opportunity to get your wine information from whoever you want now. Mm-hmm. So if I love the fact that, you know, I mean, Wisconsin is a little bit more, there's more stuff there, but there are some people who live in Nebraska, Iowa, in South Dakota, who do not have any access to wine education at all. And they can sign up for my classes and take them and learn about wine. And that, to me, is one of the greatest things about how we've moved into the virtual world. It's the most positive thing, is that we realize that you don't have to be, you know, because you live somewhere, you don't have to be tied to, okay, well, this is all I have, right? This is all my resources. But I will tell you equally, I have a lot of people in New York and San Francisco who take the classes because they don't like the attitude of people there who are teaching them wine either. So it's interesting.
We're talking with Elizabeth Schneider, certified sommelier. She's a podcaster, author of Wine for Normal People. You can join in with your questions about wine. She'll take them, 800-642-1234. Becky is with us from La Crosse. Hi, Becky.
Hi, thank you. I am so enjoying this discussion. I'm going to have to check out your podcast. So I've always had a fairly narrow selection of wines that I would drink. And then the pandemic hit and I started trying some of the wine deliveries, and they would have these curated cases where someone else picks them. And so there's this huge variety. And so I've now tried so many different types of wines that, first of all, I thought I only liked reds. Turns out if I have the right whites, I like them. But just the variety and grapes that I've never heard of and places in the world that I never knew were made wine. And so, you know, that was something that I think if people want to really try a variety of wines, and almost all of them I've enjoyed, they might not all be my favorites, but it was a really good way to expand my palate.
Oh, Becky, thank you for that. What do you think, Elizabeth, with these curated cases?
Well, Becky's lucky in the sense that she found a good one, and she was able to do this. This is what I think, that these things can be fantastic, but you've got to find the right people. So there are some services that are taking what we call, you know, off-label wines, wines that they couldn't sell, or wines that are lesser quality, and they're selling those. So you don't want those. You want to do it from somebody that you trust. And the other thing is, use it as exactly, I mean, it warms my heart. It makes me feel so good that Becky just said that, because the way that she approached it is beautiful. She took these wines. She said, okay, I am going to explore. I'm going to experiment. I'm going to let the world kind of come to me. And then the next step for Becky is now trust yourself, you know, go trust yourself. And now you go make the pack, right? You go and don't be afraid. I love that it opened the world for her. I love that. That is just fantastic. And I think you just have to make sure that you find one that you trust and that has some talent behind it, right? So there's got to be some rhyme or reason to how they're picking the wines. It can't just be some black box, because a lot of times that is not a good thing.
Yeah, how do you know whether that service is going to be a good steward for bringing you those wines?
Well, I mean, some of them are specialty, right? So some of them are like vegan, or some of them are, you know, they've got what, dry farmed wines, and some of them are, you know, they've got just California, the Gold Medal Club. But my preference, and then, you know, there's the newspapers that do them. I don't prefer those. A lot of those are bulk wine. I think your local wine shop, if you've got a local wine shop, a lot of times they do a great job. I mean, I have a partner where I have a page that it's Wine Access. They do a great job with their club. There are so many that do a great job. You just have to make sure they don't have an interest. Remember, we started this conversation talking about those labels.
Mm-hmm.
And remember that wine is a big business. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars. So you've got to try to find those clubs that are saying, you know, we source from small producers, or we source from all over the world, or we source from, we've got somebody who really knows about wine picking these. If it's a faceless entity picking them, you don't want that. You want them saying, our team of blah, 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 and they've actually got a person behind it. That's a good sign.
Elizabeth Schneider is our wine guide. She hosts the podcast Wine for Normal People. What do you want to know about wine? Do you prefer red or white? What are some of your favorite dishes to enjoy with wine? What about your favorite wine and cheese pairing? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more wine with Elizabeth Schneider here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, let's get back to our conversation about wine. Do you have a passion for wine? What do you pick up on when you swirl and smell? What is it about wine that you appreciate so much? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Elizabeth Schneider is a certified specialist of wine through the Society of Wine Educators. She's with us for about 10 more minutes. Fred is joining us from Wheaton. Hi, Fred. What would you like to add?
Hi, I had two comments / questions. The first, maybe it's a borderline comment, but I'd like your guests' thoughts. White Zinfandel versus red Zinfandel. Most people are exposed to Zinfandel as white Zinfandel as a cheap wedding wine, but how wonderful a good red Zinfandel can be would be a fun discussion. And then could you talk a little bit about mega purple or other dyes and how to avoid blue teeth, blue lips, and the fact that even small wineries tend to use it?
Sure. Well, white Zinfandel is actually on the decline, which I can't say I'm unhappy about. We definitely see the trend towards that wine going a little bit the way of the dinosaur as our palates, especially in America overall, have tended towards drier wines. We're definitely more in that camp. So we do see white Zinfandel sort of having a bit more of a stigma, which is not great because wine really doesn't need that. But red Zinfandel is unbelievable. White Zinfandel is only, it is made out of the Zinfandel grape. It is essentially a rosé, but it's sweetened heavily. So that's part of, you know, in within the winemaking. So, yeah, so it is. Don't get hung up. If you have not had a red Zinfandel, you definitely should try it. And I mean, I've got some fantastic friends who make great, if you can get Nall or Peterson, I think Peterson's definitely distributed in Wisconsin. These are small producers who have been making wine for 30 and 40 years in the Dry Creek of Sonoma. And these are really world-class Zinfandels. There's some great stuff out of Amador County in the Sierra foothills of California. I mean, obviously, Zinfandel is really the grape that we think of as being California's kind of big grape. You know, it's their heritage grape. It's not the most planted by any means, but it's kind of their famed one. So, yes, if you don't associate red Zinfandel with white Zinfandel, I think that's a great point. Mega Purple is one of those things I was talking about with those the additives that those big wines use. There's also a red dye also that they use. What it is it's boiled down grape concentrate. So I wouldn't say that it's necessarily dye, but it is cheating, right? That's what we sort of call it in the wine world. It's cheating because we as wine drinkers sometimes are really skeptical of lighter colors, which I wish we wouldn't be because color is not indicative of really much. It's wine is this weird thing where you've got to rely more on your nose and your mouth, especially your nose, not your eyes as much. But we like things to look the way we want them to look. And so because we want them to look that way, they will use mega purple and big red or whatever. I forgot what the red dye is called to color these wines. Again, not poison, just cheating. That's what I would say. I mean, it's not a dye. It's grape concentrate that's got really dark color. Is it necessary? No. Do we need additives, more additives in anything? I personally don't think so, but you know, you could be the judge.
So Elizabeth,
yes, you can't tell whether somebody's used it. I will tell you that.
So Elizabeth, so when you're swirling and smelling, what are you searching for?
Well, there's a difference between what I'm searching for and what I think people who are just starting in wine should be searching for. So let me address that. Wine is one of these things where the first thing that you smell is alcohol. So when you're getting into wine, you got to learn to sort of see past that. And one of the things, so take small sniffs. Do not be like, you know, you go to the perfume counter. Well, you know, in better times, you go to the perfume counter. They spray that stuff on you. You smell it for the next 45 minutes, right? That's nose fatigue. You don't, like your smell receptors are very delicate. So you want to make sure you don't overwhelm them. So don't, you know, sniff it like an aardvark. You want to sniff tiny, tiny little, I call them dog sniffs. I love dogs, right? So, you know, your dog is a great sniffer. They have these unbelievable noses. They take these tiny little dog sniffy doggies. You want to think about doing that. Take a sniff, put it away, smell it again, keep going. The way you figure out what's in wine is starting to smell other things. We're going into spring. What a great season to be able to start smelling things. Literally stop and smell the roses. Mm-hmm. Smell your flowers. Smell the jasmine that's growing on somebody else's, you know, as you're taking your walk. Go into your spice cabinet and smell that in the morning. Smell your coffee. As you start to become more in tune with your sense of smell, which we don't do, right? We just kind of, we don't do that. We use our eyes so much. Close your eyes. Use your sense of smell. Hone it. Use your cabinet. You've got all these spices. Start to smell them. I promise you, you'll start to smell those things in the wines. Even fruit categories, you know, people get so particular. It's this kind of apple, that kind of apple. Mm-hmm. Just even knowing that it smells like apple or pear, same kind of thing. Great. Berries, great, right?
Yeah.
The reason that we do this is not, by the way, it's not so that you can write a tasting note. It's so that you can communicate with wine people, because this goes back again to this vocabulary thing that is so essential. Wine is just vocabulary and geography. The better your vocabulary is, the more you can walk into your local wine store and say, hey, I really like this wine. It tasted a lot like raspberry. I like the acidity in it. Can we find other things that are like it that I've never had before? That's a great thing. Gosh, I mean, if you give that to your wine person, they're going to come up with five things right away that will be great for you that you've never had.
Yeah, so you can give them more clues and really good clues to help point you in the next direction. Nicole called from Madison, couldn't stay with us, and she says she's a beer and bourbon person, has never really found wines that she's liked. What should she be looking for a wine flavor, considering her preferences right now?
Well, bourbon really, you know, actually right now there's a lot of wines that have been aged in bourbon barrels, right? Mm-hmm. So she may want to start out with some of these very bold style wines because that's what she's used to. And also pay attention to the kind of beer that you're drinking. Do you like sours? You know, if you like that, you're going to want to go for something that is a heavier wine with maybe a little bit more tannin, honestly. That's not where most people start, but depending on what kind of beer you like, there's sort of a mapping that you can do. If you like a lighter style, you know, an IPA, then maybe you might do a white, but it's going to have to be maybe an oaky Chardonnay. Those bolder flavors are usually what somebody like that is going to start out with. And then what you'll find is you'll start to appreciate the nuance in those wines, and then you'll move. You know, people usually start out with very bold wines, mm-hmm. and then they move to more nuanced wines because they start to get more out of the wines, and then they say, well, let me try this. This is really interesting. And then you'll be on your way, right? Because, yeah. Again, unlimited amounts of wine that you could try that are so interesting.
Okay, we only have a few seconds left. Elizabeth, what will you sip tonight, may I ask?
Tonight, I am actually going to have a Finger Lakes Riesling because I took part in a Riesling camp and from the Finger Lakes. And that is a world-class Riesling region. I love Riesling. It's the grape that got me into wine. So I will be having a dry Riesling from Red Newt Winery.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun.
Elizabeth Schneider is a certified sommelier through the Court of Master Sommeliers. She's host of the podcast Wine for Normal People. Check it out. We have a link to it at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.